from Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. The Palestinian Center for Human Rights called 2014 one of the worst years in history for Palestinians in the besieged Gaza Strip due to Israeli human rights violations. As it released its annual report for the year, PCHR focused on Israeli war crimes, particularly during its recent war on Gaza. Press TV's Ashraf Shannon was at the conference and filed this report from Gaza.
The Palestinian Center for Human Rights, PCHR, has released its annual report for 2014, focusing on Israeli war crimes, especially during Israel's 50-day war on Gaza, in a ceremony attended by dozens of human rights advocates and academics. During the war on Gaza, Israeli forces killed and injured thousands of people, including hundreds of children and women. Israeli forces also bombed and destroyed thousands of residential buildings, displacing tens of thousands of people. The Palestinian Center for Human Rights has already filed several lawsuits against Israeli leaders for their crimes against Palestinians in previous wars.
It's simple and clear. We have to apply rule of law, not the rule of jungle, meaning Israel should be held accountable. They committed war crimes, crimes against humanity, and they are still committing. We are trying to proceed and to bring Israel to the ICC International Criminal Court and to have it there to have the final word.
In its report, PCHR highlighted the grave human rights violations perpetrated by Israeli forces against the Palestinians, especially in the Gaza Strip.
What happened during the war on Gaza, according to our documentations and investigation, we are talking about large-scale attack on civilians. We are talking about war crimes, some of them tantamount to crimes against humanity.
Experts say Israel's impunity has given it the green light to carry out war crimes against Palestinians.
Diplomatic immunity toward Israeli generals and Israeli leaders, I believe, is the most important factor that enable Israel to continue with its crimes and aggression against the Palestinian people over and over again.
11 months after Israel's deadly war on Gaza, PCHR lawyers say it's important to hold events like this to remind the world of Israeli crimes, as devastation remains and wounds are still fresh. Ashraf Shannon, Press TV Gaza.
A dozen years after the U.S. invasion that was supposed to bring peace, freedom, and prosperity to the country, Iraq is facing a major humanitarian catastrophe, with 10 million people expected to need aid by the end of this year. That, according to the United Nations. An estimated 5.5 million people have been displaced or otherwise affected by ongoing terrorist violence, which began shortly after the U.S. invasion in 2003. As fighting continues to escalate, the U.N. issued an appeal for approximately $500 million to provide food, shelter, water, and other life-saving services over the next 6 months. U.N. journalist Basma Begal asked Simon Ingram, based in Jordan with the UN Children's Fund, UNICEF, about the current situation in the war-ravaged country.
Well, I think that the catastrophe is really one, you know, clear way and an accurate way of depicting it, because the situation in Iraq, almost unnoticed, I think, to a large extent, has escalated very, very seriously over the past year and a half, during which time we have seen a massive increase in the number of people being displaced and the number of communities being affected by the violence, the conflict, which is taking place now in many different parts of the country. Up to about a year ago, the crisis was being felt primarily in the north of the country, which was when we had the takeover by the ISIL forces of Mosul. However, that has changed now. We're seeing conflict spreading as a counteroffensive gets underway in the areas to the west and northwest of Baghdad. So the effects of the crisis are now much worse. And this comes at a time when the humanitarian organizations who are trying to deal with the needs of more than 8 million people, the financial resources are drying up. So that is why we're talking about a catastrophe at this point in time.
Five Ukrainian troops were killed and 39 injured in fighting Wednesday in eastern Ukraine. That, according to an aide to the Ukrainian president Thursday. The statement came after rebel officials said 5 civilians and 14 members of a militia were killed during Wednesday's shelling of the city of Donetsk by Kiev's forces. According to local officials, Ukrainian government forces had shelled the area 58 times.
We are disturbed by reports, including those from the OSCE, that combined Russian separatist forces launched coordinated attacks overnight against Ukrainian positions near Donetsk City in Pisky, Luhansk, and Marinka. We are now seeing unconfirmed reports that the town of Marinka may have fallen. These attacks by combined Russian separatist forces are on the Ukrainian side of the ceasefire line. They have reportedly utilized Grad rockets and other heavy weapons that should have been withdrawn under the February Minsk plan, and they've reportedly killed at least one and injured 20 Ukrainians. Any new attack or aggressive action by combined Russian separatist forces is unacceptable and contravenes the Minsk agreements. Russia bears direct responsibility for preventing these attacks and implementing a ceasefire. Any attempts to seize additional Ukrainian territory will be met with increased costs.
That was Marie Harf, the U.S. State Department spokesperson, at her daily press conference in Washington Wednesday. But when questioned by Gayan Shichikayan, a reporter with RT, about the basis of her claims, she was unable to provide specifics.
Last week, your colleague here at the briefing said that Ukraine's rebel forces are responsible for, quote, the overwhelming number of violations of the Minsk agreements. I'm looking at the OIC daily reports for the last 2 months, daily reports of violations. And here's what they show. Ceasefire violations. In 9 of their reports, it appears that Donetsk and Lugansk forces have violated the ceasefire. In 8 of their reports, it appears that the Ukrainian government has violated the ceasefire. In 9 of the reports, it was not clear who violated that ceasefire. Now, withdrawal of heavy weapons. Rebel forces, 33 reports of violations. Government forces, 35 reports of violations. This is hardly a vast majority behind that.
I have a question. Go ahead.
Where do you, and I mean the State Department, get the information that the rebel forces are responsible for the vast majority of violations?
From a variety of sources, including the OSCE. So I'm happy to take a look at what you quoted specifically and look at the numbers underlying that.
I'm looking at
But there are a lot of numbers daily, here, and a lot of daily. People can use numbers in different ways, and I want to take a look at them myself. But what we know from the OSCE, again, I can take a look at what numbers you're quoting, and I'm happy to get into them specifically and see what more we can
the
say.
The daily reports, their daily reports do not show an overwhelming majority.
I think our experts who look at them say something different. So let me go back to our team. But everything we're getting from the OSCE and other sources of information indicates that a vast majority, as my colleague said, are from the Russian separatist combined forces. So we can go through the numbers, and I'm happy to do that. But again, I would also mention that the Russian separatist forces are preventing OSCE access in many places, and they're not letting them in to see what's actually going on.
A simple question. Mm-hmm. Do you acknowledge that the Ukrainian government, too, is violating the Minsk agreements?
Well, I think by saying a vast majority are the Russian separatist forces, that would then indicate that a very small minority are on the other side. But let's also remember
here. That is not clear from the OSCE daily
report. I just told you I would look at them, and we can get into a numbers game here and see what numbers you're using and what other experts, including our team, says.
Harf's claims were further challenged by satellite images obtained and leaked by the Ukrainian hacktivist group Cyber Berkut, which hacked into emails of Major General Andriy Taran, chief of the Joint Center for Ceasefire Control and Coordination in Ukraine, recovering pictures that prove multiple violations of the Minsk peace agreements by Kiev. Among them are pictures showing that Kiev had its heavy artillery stationed in the immediate vicinity of the border with the Donbas republics, violating the terms of the ceasefire agreement, and hacked emails showing that Tatiana Podobinska-Shtik, a staff member of the U.S. Embassy in Ukraine, was aware of the situation. Podobinska-Shtik said in the hacked emails, quote, "Sending you pictures which can become a serious problem for you. Think about how you can explain them if the monitoring mission obtains them. Consult the team leader and think about a possible action plan. How can you justify them or present them as fake?" Closed quote. The U.S. military will get unlimited access to Estonia's military facilities and the possibility of building their infrastructure there. That, according to a report from the Russian news agency TASS. The Estonian government reportedly approved the deal Thursday as part of a plan aimed at renovating military bases, including Emari Air Base, which is used by NATO's fighter jets, and the central firing ground of Estonia's armed forces in Tapa. Meanwhile, Russia will supply its S-300 air defense system to Iran soon, according to TASS, quoting Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, who said that the subject of the S-300 system was not discussed during a meeting with his Iranian counterpart, Javad Zarif, Thursday. Quote, "We merely stated that preparations for the delivery are underway and the deal will be effected soon," closed quote. Russian President Vladimir Putin will meet with Pope Francis on June 10th at the Vatican. The meeting will take place in the afternoon, according to the Vatican spokesperson, Reverend Federico Lombardi. Russian presidential spokesperson Dmitry Peskov had said earlier that a meeting between Putin and Pope Francis was in the works. Putin is also expected to visit the Russian pavilion at the Expo World's Fair in Milan. Greece's creditors dodged a bullet Thursday as the IMF, one of the lenders seeking concessions from Athens, said the country had opted to bundle its four debt repayments to the IMF into a single payment at the end of June, skipping Friday's deadline for the first installment. The statement essentially means that the feared default by Athens on its June payment Friday has been postponed until the end of the month. No further information was available at press time. For the decades following the reign of former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger, U.S. foreign policy has been largely directed by the thinking of two men, former Carter administration national security advisors Zbigniew Brzezinski and billionaire financier George Soros. Both men have favored a consistently hostile U.S. foreign policy, in particular against Russia and, to a lesser extent, China. But, according to a number of international observers, recent events may be causing the elites in the U.S. to rethink their adherence to the advice of these two men. One such observer is Umberto Pascali, an Italian writer and independent analyst based in Washington, D.C. Widely known as an observer of U.S. foreign policy, with an emphasis on geostrategy and the deep link between national sovereignty and economic progress, his work is focused on strategic issues and European geopolitics, with a particular focus on Italy. He's researched and written about irregular warfare, popularly known as terrorism, and co-authored Who Killed Aldo Moro, about the assassination of the political leader in 1978. He's also researched the assassination of the president of the Deutsche Bank, Alfred Herrhausen, among others. Pascali also spent many years doing field research in the Balkans in a number of conflict countries, most recently in Macedonia. We spoke with him via Skype from Washington Thursday. Welcome back, and I'd like to maybe follow up the things that you were talking about with particularly with Mr. Soros and also Mr. Brzezinski. It seems both of them may be finally on the outs.
I don't know if they are definitely on the out, but there are many signs that their masters are not so sure anymore that that's the line to follow. And I explain, you know, the policy, the foreign policy or the strategic policy of the United States is not made by the Congress or even by the White House, as at this point I think many people know. They receive a certain general line and presidents are elected to carry this line, like happened with Obama. And then they try to do the best of that. But what doesn't change with the time are the top advisor, let's call it the top grand commis on foreign policy, strategic policy. Now, we had several president, Democrat, and Republican in the last decades. But one thing that was already always there was Zbigniew Brzezinski, and later on, more prominently and more publicly, George Soros. These are the people who give the line. These are the people that, after the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989, decided that there should not be a détente, a collaboration between East and West, but there should be a further escalation of aggression by NATO toward East and toward conquering the East and looting the East for raw materials. This was not a line that was perfectly obvious in 1989. Actually, it was something that nobody expected, but that's the line that won. The relationship, why Brzezinski, the beginning of Brzezinski is so important, why Soros is so important. Brzezinski struck a deal, a friendship, like a dog with the master, with the top of the Wall Street, with the top of the Chase Manhattan Bank, David Rockefeller. David Rockefeller met the young Brzezinski, that was a chauvinist young guy that was related with the British intelligence. He was in London during the war and so on. And he was a geopolitician, a small Polish nobility. And Brzezinski gave him the speech, and the trilateral commission was created. This trilateral commission looks so mysterious. It was a meeting between Brzezinski and David Rockefeller, and there was the financing. They had the idea that they could restructure the world in three parts, and basically cancel the Soviet Union, the Russia, that was always the fixed point, and to keep the Europeans under control. Now, this policy of Brzezinski is a policy that gave us the Ukrainian crisis, the Syrian crisis, the Afghanistan crisis, because it was Brzezinski that one day chose a governor from Georgia called Jimmy Carter, got him in the Trilateral Commission and decided that he would be the next president. Now, whatever Carter was thinking, the strategic policy was done by Brzezinski, and Brzezinski created Afghanistan and created the Al-Qaeda, as he confessed openly in an interview to the Nouvel Observateur, the French magazine. Then there was, the great chessboard, the most famous book of Brzezinski, that explained exactly how he will reshape through war and blood the whole Eurasian continent. The Arab Spring and the Coral Revolution, okay, the operative on the field was Soros, as we know, with all his organization, open society, open every society with this open air that he has. But the strategy was from Brzezinski. So people should understand that these are the kind of people who make policies.
Right, and Brzezinski even actually took an official position with Carter. He was the NSA director, right?
Yes, he was the National Security Council advisor for Carter. And he decided, probably, I don't know how much Carter even understood, he decided, for example, all the trick in Afghanistan, right, the creation of, Bin Laden, to right. send Bin Laden there, right. and to send this basically gangster, and to provoke the Russia. The Russia wanted to withdraw, but Brzezinski didn't allow with this policy of continuous provocation. He and Soros have done the policy until now. Now, the difference between what happened since 1989 up to now, the new fact, the new element, is that a series of countries, and this is with the emerging of Putin, of Vladimir Putin, as leader of Russia in 1999, after the war in Kosovo, after the war against Serbia, it was considered a potential Russian ally and, above all, two independent country. So there was this illegal war launched against Serbia. This provoked a reaction in Russia and of the soft line with Yeltsin. The great illusion in Russia was, we have a deal with the West, they will let us prosper. They understood that you have a deal with Brzezinski and he will kill you. So magically, suddenly Putin emerged. I remember very well at the time of the war in Kosovo, this completely illegal war, not approved by the UN, by anybody. I was in Washington at a meeting a press conference with Brzezinski, General Odom of former NSA boss. And the proposal of Brzezinski was, we are not able to break Serbia from the bombing, mostly coming from Italy, from the NATO bases in Italy. So we don't succeed in breaking Serbia. So we should prepare a ground invasion from Hungary. And I remember I asked a question, sorry, Mr. Brzezinski, but my question is, have you tried to provoke World War III or you are just insane and absolutely crazy? At the end, I tried to discuss with him, but I think he was becoming physically violent. But that's the kind of person is. It's people don't realize they've put the destiny of the United States foreign policy in the hand of a psychopath. Mm. Now, I think there is the beginning of realization, because until they had the psychopath in their hand, and the psychopath would always win, you know, kill, 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 war, 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 and they would apparently succeed, then they let the psychopath do his bloody work. When, like now, there is a reaction, there is the emerging of a coordinated opposition and an alternative with the BRICS, you know, the coalition of Russia, China, India, Brazil, South Africa, and with the new BRICS bank, the bank for development of the BRICS, with the, like we were discussing last time, with the AIIB, the bank for building infrastructure in Asia, and other such banks and financial institutions, alternative, absolutely alternative, outside the reach of International Monetary Fund, World Bank, and the Federal Reserve, all the dollar empire. This is a kind of process that is absolutely outside the what we can call the Western financial powers.
Right.
Then they get scared. And then they say, is this really a good thing for us to have the two psychopaths, Soros and Brzezinski, or they are getting us in real troubles?
So for the first time, they're, you know, since the fall of the Berlin Wall, they're forced to confront this. What alternative, who's lined up behind Soros and Brzezinski to offer advice to this group?
Well, this is still, I think, in discussion, and they are preparing something. There is an indication, though it's I don't know the person that physically will substitute, if ever, right?
Right.
Because this is not a final diagnosis. But if you see lately, when there was a major crisis, the crisis was solved by an institution officially outside the game, even if it's nobody's outside the big game. I'm talking about the Vatican. If you if you saw in September 2013, the UN was voting for the invasion of Syria. Would ever be like Serbia?
Right.
Would there have been an armed invasion? And Russia was coming strongly against the European, most of the European, where the big European country, France, Germany, Italy, Spain, they were against, but they were terrorized. They know what Brzezinski could do to them, or what the U.S. apparatus in the end of Brzezinski could do to them. Mm. So was possible to arrive to a general bloodbath in Middle East and North Africa. Putin had intervened, but of course it was not enough. Then the Pope intervened, sent a letter to Putin saying basically, I agree with you, we should stop the war. And then he launched a series of prayer, staying up all night, praying in St. Peter's Square, something, you know, I don't mean show in a negative sense, but it was a show that you know, people were very impressed. I don't think the Vatican was able or willing to do this thing by its own. Like, I challenge the world because I believe in the gospel and peace. But there was some encouragement. Second case, and there was no bombing, and there was no invasion. The plan, the Obama plan, the Brzezinski plan that was already there, ready to be fulfilled, was forgotten. Then there was recently Macedonia. You know, there was the color revolution in Macedonia.
Yes.
How could Macedonia, you know, I have a particular connection with Macedonia for many years. I have been there many times. How can a country so small, so, vulnerable like Macedonia could resist the apparatus of Soros? So the color revolution was a done deal. Except that the Macedonia resisted. And then suddenly there was this strange situation in which the Prime Minister Gruevski of Macedonia had, the plan that was taking him back to Skopje had this accident in Vienna. Instead of then going to Skopje, he went to Rome and met the Pope. And now the situation is calm. It's strangely calm. You know, the opposition stopped doing the show of the tents, the people in the street, the color revolution paraphernalia. It's over. If you go to Skopje, there are no tents anymore. But what does it mean? Now, again, today, the sudden news, first that Putin would go to Italy to see the Expo in Milan, the famous Expo in Milan. But then, being in Italy, it will be received by the Pope. The Pope said that he has a great benevolence toward Russia and he wants to discuss in depth the problem and see solution and so on. Strange language. Huh?
Yeah, there's an interesting symmetry here too, because it was the Pope that was very heavily involved in the fall of the Iron Curtain. Karol Józef Wojtyła, the so-called Polish Pope, became Pope around a year or so before Brzezinski set off on the Afghan adventure. It was essentially when he and Carter were becoming firmly entrenched in Washington.
And that's done. This is an interesting point you're making. First of all, because you know how Wojtyła was elected. Before him, there was the Cardinal Patriarch of Venice that was elected, Albino Luciani. He lasted 1 month, then right. He strangely died.
Right. And there's all kinds of theories on that, right.
And the previous Pope, Paul VI, accused to be a Pope with the leftist sympathy, absolutely absurd, but that's the way of thinking of the Vatican, of the American embassy in Via Veneto in Rome. He also died of basically broken heart because his political protege, Aldo Moro, had been kidnapped by the Red Brigades, quote unquote,
right.
And kept 1 month and then killed and let be found in the middle of Rome after he had even done an appeal, men of the Red Brigades, don't kill this just man and so on. There was a big war. There was a big war inside the Vatican, outside. Now, without going for all the detail, the point was they were preparing for the post-Soviet world.
Right.
Until then, there was, East and West, free world and communism. And Europe had to be divided, the division of Europe. And you remember the famous slogan of the first secretary of NATO when he was asked, what the NATO is for? Well, the NATO is to keep the American in, the Russia out, and the German down.
Right.
Now, if you substitute the Germans with Europeans, then you have a clear picture of what NATO is for. And so at that point, there was the illusion that Europe could be independent.
We'll have part two of that interview tomorrow. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.